Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument, United States v. White. Mr. Ridgway.
Good morning. May it please the Court, William Ridgway on behalf of the United States. The District Court erred in subjecting this case to Brandenburg v. Ohio, and in so doing, usurped the jury's role. Brandenburg governs abstract advocacy and has never been held to extend to the solicitation of a crime of violence. And that distinction is embodied in Section 373 itself, whose requirements of strong corroboration of intent and actual efforts to persuade others to commit a crime of violence more than ensure that abstract advocacy is not prescribed. This sort of expansive view of Brandenburg that the district court embraced and the defendant now urges has been rejected, and most pointedly in the Supreme Court in United States v. Williams. That's a case in which the 11th Circuit had held that the pandering of child pornography would be subject to Brandenburg, and the Supreme Court reversed that decision, saying that that ruling confused the distinction between abstract advocacy and offers to engage in illegal activities. And in particular, in that ruling, the Supreme Court cited the longstanding prescription of criminal solicitation, citing the Model Penal Code. So I think that suggests that that distinction is something the Supreme Court certainly agrees with. And likewise, First Amendment challenges have been rejected with respect to this very statute in the Second Circuit, in United States v. Rahman, in United States v. Sitar. Both are those cases involving what could be construed as general calls for violence, but in both those circumstances, the courts restricted that understanding, said they were not protected by the First Amendment because they crossed the line into criminal solicitation.
But in that Sitar case, the fatwa was released to a general audience, but at least it contained an explicit request, which is not our situation here.
That's correct, Your Honor. It contained a request for, I believe, the murder of Jews wherever found, and that could be construed as a general call for violence, but in the context, it spoke to specific acts of murder. Here, the actual request is not to contain a specific call for harm, but I think in the context of the website, that language could mean only one thing, and that was what the defendant was intending for harm to be carried out against that juror. In other contexts, this court...
What was the strongest indication of that?
The strongest indication of that, I believe, is on the website itself, the previous calls for violence against various enemies of white supremacy, along with the disclosure of that person's personal information. Also, there's going to be evidence presented about the readership, the people who are reading this website. And finally, of course, there's evidence in terms of the defendant's own acknowledgement that the publication of this personal information could present a grave risk of danger to those involved.
Is there any evidence about it, or will there be evidence about how many people visit the website?
There will be evidence presented at a trial in terms of the readership, and also in terms of something. It's not on the record, but basically an automatic email update was sent out to a set of people. So there would be evidence presented in terms of the readership of the website, and that there were followers who received daily updates in terms of what was being posted on this website. It's worth emphasizing that the solicitations oftentimes are coded and oftentimes don't contain explicit language. And I think the clearest example of that is the Hale case, in which the actual solicitation, the language that constituted the solicitation in that case, was as do find Judge Lefkoe's address for whatever reason you wish it to be. That's clearly not an explicit call for violence against Judge Lefkoe. But given the circumstances of the relationship between Matthew Hale and the government informant presented at trial, the sort of evidence that was borne out at trial, those words were held to be the triggering solicitation. So it's clearly not the case that one must call for violence explicitly, or else they're subject to the strictures of Brandenburg. There's a number of solicitations that are coded or purposefully in order to avoid being caught by law enforcement.
Is there any? Is there
talk about context? What if it was a standalone, that particular email?
Sorry, I didn't hear your question.
What if it was a standalone email, just the central email?
Simply providing the address?
No, I'm just trying to get the building blocks here versus the context? And what if it was a standalone?
If there was no other context in terms of the relationship and something that would suggest what that address meant, I think it would be difficult to show strongly corroborative circumstances of the person's intent in that circumstance, unless there's something else in the computer that suggested that when I provide this address, you will do X or something along those lines. I do think context is necessary. That's why the statute requires strongly corroborative circumstances of the defendant's intent. And that's something that we plan to present at trial, should this go to a trial.
Is there any evidence or any way to prove that White's intent was to have another person harm Juror A as opposed to an intent to have others harass Juror A? Will there be evidence?
Your Honor, the evidence will be that the defendant intended harm to befall Juror A, not harassment. And the evidence of that will both be in terms of the website itself. There's also evidence that's not in the record that will suggest that's what the defendant's intent was in this case. But again, the website, I think, alone is enough, sufficient in terms of setting forth an indictment in terms of apprising the defendant of the nature of the charges, which is all that indictment must do in order to proceed to trial, that indictment is sufficient in apprising the defendant of the nature of the charges in this case. And in that regard, it's important to emphasize the fact that the district court not only embraced the wrong First Amendment standard, it improperly scrutinized this indictment. It claimed it was construing all facts.
What would be a situation which would be proper to dismiss an indictment?
Your Honor, the examples I saw in the Seventh Circuit generally fall along the lines of if there was an indictment with respect to a bank that was actually not FDIC insured. These are the sorts of defects in the indictment that would render an indictment invalid. I think the other examples generally the ruling is that there was actually no crime committed, and there's no way that it could be held any other way. And it's pretty rare. I didn't find very many examples of indictments being dismissed.
Suppose in your bank example, suppose the indictment just says that the defendant robbed a bank and in violation of federal bank robbery law, and it didn't say anything about it's being FDIC insured or, you know, regulated by federal, being a national bank or anything. So would an indictment be dismissed because it didn't include that allegation, or wouldn't the defendant have to, you know, ask for a bill of particulars or something?
Your Honor, that's generally the course of conduct in that sort of circumstances, that the defendant will request a bill of particulars, and in that circumstance, I think he would be warranted in that circumstance, because one of the elements of the crime is not being alleged in the indictment. The indictment must contain all the elements of the crime and generally give the nature of the crime, the timeline, so that a defendant can use that indictment to prevent future prosecutions. That's the main purpose of an indictment. Defendant's response to this case law, it generally seems to acknowledge the fact that solicitations aren't normally subject to Brandenburg, but to say that his solicitation was different because it wasn't explicit. And I think it's important to keep in mind that the cases that were presented did not present any sort of clarity requirement, any sort of explicitness requirement. That's something that the defendant generates from the facts of the cases, not at all from the holdings of those cases. And it also doesn't really make sense. As I mentioned before, there are a great number of coded solicitations, and that would only encourage coded solicitations if it was held that so long as you make your solicitation less explicit, then it has to be subject to Brandenburg. That's a very strict standard, and I think it would only encourage the more savvy criminals to know to make their solicitations not explicit. If the panel doesn't have any questions at this time, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ridgway. Mr. Sannon?
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Nishay Sannon. I represent the appellee, Mr. White, in this case. Your Honors, it is our position that district court did not err when it scrutinized this indictment under Brandenburg, the First Amendment, and the cases that followed out of the Supreme Court. If you look at the history, the Senate judiciary history that came out when Section 373 was enacted, which is the solicitation statute, they specifically said, they actually addressed the concerns of the First Amendment and say in a majority of circumstances the First Amendment wouldn't apply. But there are situations where the First Amendment would apply. And in specifically doing so, if you look at what they said in their report, the committee quoted, the solicitation involves a hiring or a partnership arrangement designed to accomplish a specific action in violation of law, where the communication is an essential link in a direct chain leading to criminal action. Although the action may have been interrupted, in short, the person charged with solicitation must, in a direct sense, have been a participant in an abortive crime of violence. In this situation, all you have is what took place in the Carmichael case. You have a posting of the personal information and some statements about the sexual connotation of Juror A.
See what this has to do with the First Amendment, though. It's a question is whether it's a criminal solicitation. If it is, it's not protected by the First Amendment.
But, Your Honor, you have to look at the speech that they are alleging is a solicitation. You look at the Carmichael case, in which the speech, quote-unquote, that is protected by the First Amendment, and the cases that follow, is the posting of names and addresses of individuals who were either government informants or government agents. In that case, just by posting that information, that speech is protected.
But in those cases, the websites explicitly disclaimed any violence and stated their purpose was to provide information. Isn't that right?
In the Carmichael case, he did say he did not intend any harm, but then you can look at also the Planned Parenthood case. Even though the Planned Parenthood case cited in a 6-5 split decision in favor of the plaintiffs, even the majority stated the website, which contained information, home addresses, and information about doctors. It had different colors for the doctors' names if they had been killed, and discussed that they were performing abortion.
I don't see what work the First Amendment does. It's either a solicitation to commit violence, or it's not a solicitation. If it's a solicitation, it's actionable, and if it's not, it's not a violation. So I don't make it to the First Amendment.
Because, Your Honor, with all...
Also, do you disagree with Mr. Ridgway that there are coded solicitations?
Judge, there are coded solicitations. There's no disagreement as to that.
So why isn't the issue here simply whether the indictment contains enough indication of a coded solicitation to avoid dismissal?
Because the speech that they state is the actual solicitation is protected free speech.
No, but that's where the coding comes. You look at the total context to see what the readers of this speech would understand, whether they were being invited to commit a crime or invited to do something else.
But, Judge, if you look at the context of this case, even going back to there...
Why don't you look at the context without the evidence, though? What Mr. Ridgway says, if there's some vagueness in the indictment, well, you ask for a bill of particulars. As he said, the purpose of the indictment apprise you of the nature of the charges and also provide a basis for a double jeopardy in the event of a future prosecution. So it's very odd to have an indictment dismissed just because it doesn't list all the evidence necessary to convince a jury that this was a criminal solicitation.
Judge, with all due respect, an indictment also has to at least list a violation of a statute.
Excuse me?
An indictment has to at least list what
It certainly doesn't list a violation of this. It certainly does assert a violation of the statute. Maybe it doesn't list enough evidence to establish proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but the indictment doesn't have to list the evidence.
Judge, I agree with you. The indictment does not have to list evidence proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but the indictment has to give a plain violation of a statute that occurs. Here...
It doesn't give a plain violation. It just has to... You just have to... As Mr. Ridgway said, it has to list the elements of the crime, which is not the evidence, and it has to... has to describe the crime in a general way. But the purpose there is to provide a basis for pleading double jeopardy in a later case. It doesn't have to list all the evidence.
Judge, I don't disagree with you. It doesn't have to list all the evidence, but it has to list a violation of a statute.
What do you mean, list a violation? It alleges a violation. That's what a charging document does. It alleges the violation. It doesn't allege the. It doesn't allege all the evidence that would, you know, help to show that it was a crime.
But Judge, if you look at what they allege the violation is, their term of art is a solicitation. It is a posting of the name and address of a juror. That is what they are considering the solicitation.
No, they're not arguing that merely to post the name and address of a juror is per se a criminal solicitation. It's a step in a criminal solicitation because there are other things going on. There's a history and so on. There's other language in the website. That's what you're ignoring. Also, I don't know, you don't believe that the First Amendment entitles people to post names and addresses of jurors.
Judge, the case.
That's ridiculous. Look, there are jurors whose identity is not disclosed, right?
That's correct, Judge. The anonymous jurors.
There are witnesses whose identity is not disclosed. There are child witnesses in, you know, child abuse cases. They're allowed their privacy, and it can be a crime to reveal the privacy of to reveal the identity of a juror, of other government officials.
Well, Judge, I strongly disagree with that. The Carmichael case.
Are you saying, for example, that if you have a jury in some gang case and so on, there threats and maybe they've killed jurors and something like some sort of thing that the juror's name and address can't be concealed?
Judge, if it's ordered by the court, yes, it can be. We have anonymous juries that happen in this district all the time, but that's not the situation.
So what you're saying is that anonymity of jurors, providing anonymity for jurors, does not violate the First Amendment.
That's correct, Judge. What's the difference between your argument, Judge? You even said naming the list of agents or snitches. What the Carmichael case said that is not a violation of the law, and it's protected free speech. In Carmichael, the defendant posted names.
Look, what you're asserting, you're saying two opposite things. The first thing you said was that somehow the First Amendment creates a right to know the name and address of jurors. Now, of course, you backpedal and you realize that isn't true. There's a reason to conceal the juror's identity, then a court can do it.
Judge, I'm not saying the First Amendment gives you a right to get that information, and I apologize if I misspoke on that. The First Amendment doesn't protect the right to get that. But in the Matthew Hale cases, who the juror that was involved in the juror A in this posting? Number one, the court never said that you cannot release the names of the jurors. The juror's name was public record. It was posted in the majority of the newspapers when this verdict came down. The information that Mr. White took was all public information that was available on multiple websites. He took it and put it on his website. So I agree with you when you say the first...
It doesn't have anything to do with the First Amendment. I mean, if someone goes out and kills someone, they can find the address of the person. Right? I mean, what does that have to do? Names and addresses? What does that do with the First Amendment?
Well, Judge, obviously the Carmichael Court said that is posted...
What do you think it has to do with the First Amendment?
Judge, it's protected free speech. If I put on my website the name and address of someone who I don't like, that's protected free speech. It doesn't mean I'm...
I don't see what that has to do with free speech.
Well, Judge, you have to look at what the statement or the solicitation that is being made. It's the speech that is being made that the government is trying to criminalize. Here, they're trying to criminalize Mr. White putting the juror's information on his website and saying...
If he put it on the website and coupled with an explicit solicitation, there'd be no First Amendment issue.
If he said, if you put the name and just says, go kill this person, I agree. That would be outside the bounds of the First Amendment. That goes also back into the issue of the true threat case law that's
pending. What if he said, the famous example, Henry II and Cardinal Becket, where he said, Henry II said, will no one rid me of this pestilent priest? And then his henchmen go out and kill the cardinal. So that would be a coded solicitation. Now, is that punishable?
Judge, I don't believe so. Because his speech is protected.
Not punishable? You're kidding.
For his statement, go do this? Judge, it would be no different than the statement made by Charles Evers that we're going to break people's necks. What's the difference between that statement and the statement in
No. This is a specific person. It says, will no one rid me of this pestilent priest, Cardinal Beckett? And you're saying that can't be criminalized?
Judge, no. Under the First Amendment, can't. It's no different than the Clyburn case, where Judge, Mr. Evers.
That's a classic example of coded solicitation, right? Say, will no one rid me of this pestilent priest? And it's understood by everybody. What he's saying is, go and kill that guy.
Well, Judge, with all due respect, what's the difference in the Clyburn case when Mr. Evers says, the necks will be broken by our people, break their necks? They'll answer to me. What's the difference? He's stating that people's necks will be broken if they continue to do business with these white organizations. Yet
the
Supreme Court...
Thing, he's not naming these people.
Judge, there is a list posted of the people who are doing business with the white merchants. He lists it. They're spoken at a speech. And he says those people's necks will be broken. Yet the Supreme Court protects that as First Amendment free speech. Here, all we have is the posting of information. There's no statement made by Mr. Weiss's, go break the neck of this juror, go do this, go do that. It's just not here. The speech in this case is far less even advocating any type of criminal action than the Supreme Court has found to be protected.
Yeah, but we have to look at this speech in the context of the web page and the call for violence when you look at the history of the web page.
Correct. You look to the website and Judge Adelman...
And you agree that it has to be looked at in context. You agree that
I agree with that, yes. It would be no different than the Planned Parenthood case, Your Honor, where they looked at the website in the context of everything that took off. Even if you look at the Seventh Circuit...
Distinguish that from the Evers case.
Which, the Planned Parenthood case, Judge? In the Planned Parenthood case, they said the website, which contained information regarding the doctor's names, where it had some of the names X'd out, they said the website alone, even the majority in the 6-5 split, said that was First Amendment protected. If you apply that case to the Clyburn, they said that the statements that he made about breaking necks was First Amendment protected. Your Honors, even if you look at the Kamari case, which came out of this circuit, where Your Honors decided that was not protected free speech, you looked at the context, you look at the information that's...
Yeah, I don't understand why you talk about the First Amendment. You're saying it's not a solicitation. You're not saying that there are criminal solicitations that are privileged, are you?
No, Judge, but the speech to make the solicitation, or the speech attacking as a solicitation. I'm sorry?
Solicitation is always speech.
Well, it may not be solicitation because it's protected by the First Amendment. You have to look at the speech itself.
Well, let's get back to this Clyburn case, because this was a very different situation than what we have here, because Evers, in his speeches, these were lengthy addresses, you know, pleading with the black citizens to unify and respect one another and to use economic means to boycott. There was no direct threat to specific individuals. He didn't target specific individuals. He didn't give out names and addresses or photographs of particular people who should be targeted. I mean, this was a totally different situation.
But, Judge, that case is worse than the context of this case. There, they're saying they're going to break the necks of the black people
but
who
they,
do.
Yeah, but that was one phrase made sort of impromptu in the context of a very lengthy speech that talked about nonviolence and economic retribution. That's not the situation we have here with this overthrow.com.
Judge, with all due respect, and I see my time is running out, if you look at Charles Evers, he doesn't just say, I'm going to break their necks. He says, he gives information about how these people won't be sleeping with the sheriffs. He says they have to answer to him specifically that he's going to break their necks or that other people should break the necks of these people who do business with the white merchants. That is even further in extreme as to what is here in this situation. Judge, real quickly, and I know my time is running out.
If the Hale case was correctly decided or incorrectly decided?
Judge, the Hale case is distinguishable between what took place here. In Hale...
You're not answering my question. Do you think it was correctly decided?
I believe the facts in the Hale case were correctly decided. In the Hale case, though, you have a person who brings in a person and says, you're going to be my enforcer. And then he specifically gives them orders and has the ability to tell him what to do.
Would it be unconstitutional to have a law which said that jurors' names and addresses may not be posted on the Internet?
Judge, I believe it would be unconstitutional, following the Carmichael ruling. I'm sorry?
Look, I have to say I regard threats against jurors as particularly serious. Mm-hmm. Because unlike judges, you know, we get threats. We know. I mean, if you become a judge, you know you're going to get threats. But these jurors, they're draftees. They're brought into court involuntarily. And then to be subjected to this kind of exposure of their privacy, you think the First Amendment requires that?
Judge, I believe the First Amendment protects the listing of their names. This was public information. So how does it get criminalized just because Mr. White puts it out?
No, I'm saying, suppose he had a law which said it was not public information. You can't post private information about, you can't post personal information about jurors on the Internet because they're entitled to privacy. Would that be unconstitutional?
Under the Constitution, Judge, I believe it would be.
Okay. That's your view. Sure, of course.
Ms. Chen, how would you compare the contact situation in Carmichael with our case here?
Judge, in Carmichael, you have the posting of agents' names, you have the posting of confidential informants, and they specifically address the fact in that case that those people feared some type of retribution. In this case, all we have is the posting of the juror's name and address. There's nothing further, at least in the post where it lists his name.
Yeah, I mean in the broader sense of what also might be on the website.
On the Carmichael website?
Yeah.
I mean, in the Carmichael website, it was limited to that, and he did put in there no intent to harm anybody else.
I mean, I was just contrasting it with the setting of this website. That's all.
Judge, that website, the Carmichael website, was a specific website dealing with just his case that had to do with just the people who were involved in his matter.
Yeah, so I'm suggesting, is there a difference with this communication, which is embedded in this particular website?
Judge, I don't believe there's this difference because this is a website where he is putting out his political opinions, his feelings towards hot topics that are out there. And that's why it's protected free speech.
You feel the reference to the earlier postings is not proximate enough?
Judge, correctly. It's just exactly as Judge Adelman distinguished how those postings are irrelevant. And then there's a question of whether those postings could even be admitted in a trial. Even in the Matthew Hale case, when all these other quote-unquote threats were admitted, this court said that was a close call and whether they should have been admitted at all. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Senan. Mr. Ridgway, you have 2 minutes. Anything further?
Yeah, I just have a few points to make. First, on the Claiborne case, as Judge Williams pointed out, the context of that case was far different. That was part of a 3-hour speech in which all the other parts of the speech were calls for nonviolent protest. And so the phrase to break your damn necks was just hyperbolic. And more importantly, that was something that was borne out after a trial. The Claiborne case was not a case that was dismissed on the complaint or on the indictment. So it's the sort of context that can be drawn out of a trial that was not drawn out in a trial here. Also, with respect to what the context means in the Carmichael case, that's a Middle District of Alabama case. In that case, as also was pointed out, there was an explicit provision that said this website is not meant to intimidate or to harass or to do anything or to cause any harm to these individuals. And so, obviously, the context of that website was much different than the context of this website as something that will be also presented at trial. Overthrow.com was a different website than the Carmichael website. It's rather clearly different. And the fact that the defendant thinks his website is the same as Carmichael, it's just wrong. Finally, I think all this debate about context, it's important that the decider of what this context means is a jury. This is the debate about how these words, what these words mean, whether it's coded, whether these words constitute a solicitation, or as the defendant was going to argue, he's just critiquing this juror. That's something that a jury should decide. It's not something that a district court is able to decide in terms of the allegations of an indictment alone. That's really it's unprecedented for a district court to do that sort of fact-finding in terms of just an indictment. So I think, in general, that the most important point is that the context of this solicitation, that context should be decided by a jury. So if there are no further questions,
well,
we
I
ask.
I just asked one. I don't know that you'd have the answer for this, Mr. Ridgway, but the context here speaks about some pretty strong language regarding candidate Obama and Mr. Warman. Any government action against Mr. White in connection with what arguably were more explicit threats?
With respect to Mr. Warman?
Or candidate Obama. I guess it was candidate in October.
Your Honor, I don't know of any. Obviously, that's not on the record at this point, but I don't know of any action being carried out. But there is other evidence that was not contained in the indictment that will be presented at trial that bears on the defendant's intent in this case. If there are no further
questions. Another conviction of him.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The one involving Virginia Beach?
That's correct, Your Honor. He was convicted.
That doesn't involve the Obama or the Wormer?
It doesn't involve the Obama. It does have some overlap with some of the charged allegations in the indictment. For example, the Richard Warman incident. He was convicted of a threat because of that incident. So he sustained there were 4 convictions in that case, and that was a recent that recently came down. So.
Okay. Well, thank you very much to both counsel. We'll move on.